The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 176.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I've really looked forward to speaking to this gentleman. He really needs no introduction. His name is Dr. Chris Martinson. Chris, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey, George. It's such a pleasure to be here with you, all your followers. Thanks for having me on.
I'm super excited to get into this because there's so much misinformation on the internet right now regarding a lot of things, but especially a topic that you've really focused on, and that's what's going on with the virus and with COVID. I call it the cervasive sickness, so YouTube doesn't demonetize me. But I wanted to start there for some of my viewers who may have not seen your more recent content. And just from a selfish standpoint, I want to get the lowdown and I want to get kind of sift through all the fake news to determine what is accurate, what isn't, what we should be worried about, and maybe what we shouldn't be worried about. So I wanted to start off with masks and really get the lowdown on, are these things, you know, do they work? Do they not work? Do they have to be used in a certain way to work properly? Are these blue masks, are they just worthless? Is it just an N95 mask that does anything? And if so, what does it do? I think a lot of people have this false sense of security that all they have to do is just wear a piece of cloth over their face and they're good to go. And then other people might have misunderstandings from the media in maybe the completely opposite direction. So let's start there.
Well, sure, I'd be happy to. And this is safe territory because I'm going to say that masks do work, but with an asterisk. I'm going to have to put some qualifications around that, as you introed nicely. Before I go there, I need to know if we need to speak in code terms. I know you've spent a lot of time building up your YouTube channel, as you should, so have I. We just got our first strike the other day, and that's pretty serious. You know, we can't post for a week. Three strikes, you're out. Totally deplatformed, because what I had done was actually just repeat what some of the most acclaimed critical care doctors in the world were saying about this thing which shall not be named, and it was deemed medical misinformation. So, as you know, I have my PhD in pathology from Duke University. I'm eminently qualified to read clinical trial results. All we were doing was talking data, and coming from doctors who are board certified, some of the most accomplished doctors in the world in critical care, and they're getting deplatformed and minimized. So I need to know, how careful do you need to be here?
Well, let's just speak the truth and let the chips fall where they may.
that's what I did, so I got a strike. Ding. So masks. This is pretty easy. No, if you're just wearing a cloth mask and somebody else is wearing a cloth mask and they sneeze out a big giant blob of viral particles, it's not going to protect you at all. And there's a lot of confusion around this because people on both sides are saying they work, they don't work, they're mandates. Here's a study that says they don't work, but none of these studies have been done right or well. For example, big study came out of, it was a Dutch study, and people sent it to me, look, they don't work, Chris. And what they had done there, and this is, I hate to get too detailed, but sometimes, as you know, you cover the details all the time on your channel. You need the details, so they matter.
Yeah, for sure.
So in that Dutch study, this is in March. This is before, you know, people really were wearing masks. Only 5% of the Dutch population is wearing masks. So they asked people wear masks, and then they followed them. And it turned out no benefit. Why? Well, because 95% of the people around them also weren't wearing masks, and they weren't required to wear them at home. And that's where most of the transmission happens, is at home. When you're in a closed environment with people, that's where it happens. So it wasn't surprising they didn't find a lot of result from that, but people who were saying masks don't work seized on that. That's not why I think people should wear masks. Here's the reason why. We know, all the science says, that the amount of illness you get, right? You could either have a very mild case or an asymptomatic case at best, or you can really get walloped. And the difference is, we know that the amount of loading of virus that you start with matters. So if you're gonna get sick, would you rather get sick with a huge load, meaning you had no mask, somebody coughed right in your face like a 3-year-old trying to tell you a secret, you know, just like, ah. And You start with that huge load and you get really sick. Or what if you start with just a few virus particles and then it's trying to replicate, your body's fighting it, and you know, you hopefully fight it to a draw pre-symptoms, right? So at any rate, that's the whole logic behind a mask, is if it doesn't prevent you from getting sick necessarily, but if you do, you want to start with a lower inoculum, is the science term, but a lower viral starting point, because that gives your body the best chance of success.
Okay, well, I think that's going to come as a surprise to most people. I know it's kind of surprising to me that that actually matters. Not the mask, but that how much of the maybe virus you get sneezed into your face initially actually determines to a certain degree how severe the illness actually is. That's really wild. So then what would be the difference between just those blue masks that everyone wears that just are kind of disposable and the stuff that you get, like that N95 mask? If I'm not mistaken, that's the best. And then with those little blue masks, are they completely worthless after an hour and you breathe in them? I've heard that that they don't really function properly if you touch them a lot or if you breathe in them for more than like an hour or two. They're pretty much meant for like a nurse to go into a room for like 30 seconds and then take it right off and throw it in the trash.
Yeah. So the blue masks come in all sorts of different qualities, right? There's really cheap ones that are single layer. And then there's really actually fairly elegant ones that are three layers. And they actually have a little wire thing that would help create a tighter seal. So a perfect mask is one that seals all the way around your breathing holes and doesn't allow things to come in through the side and has, you know, N100 or better sort of filtration. Mm. Who's going to wear those, right? Very hard to breathe in those. Maybe if you were sitting passively somewhere, you know, it could work, but you want those. And by the way, not the ones with the valve on them, which allows you to breathe out easily, because then you're just spewing your viruses if you're using it to both prevent yourself from getting sick and to stop yourself from spreading it. So that would be the best, sealed N95 Novel. So we a lot of people use the ones they hook behind the ears like this, but you notice a lot of those have a lot of ways for things to get in around the side. Better than nothing, right? Especially in the transmission, because if you do cough or talk or sneeze, I don't know if you've seen these, George, but they have these videos where they put lasers on the side, and as people talk, just like I'm talking now, you'd be disgusted to see what's coming out of people's mouths, right? So that's the whole point of those blue masks, is mostly to stop the people who are spreading it a little bit more than to stop the people from it coming in. But both ways, notice what happens. Fewer come out, fewer come in. We've lowered the viral inoculum. You have a lower starting point. That's the whole point of this.
Okay. So that was my next question. If masks are really more to prevent you from getting it or spreading it, sounds like it's a little bit of both. So my next question would be, how is this spread and how is it not spread? I mean, you see people that are, you know, you walk within 40 feet of them and they're just like running away from you as though you're somehow just your aura is going to spread it. But if I'm not mistaken, you actually have to speak. Something has to come out of your mouth, like droplets or something like that. You're not going to get it just by looking at someone or through their BO or something like that. Is that a correct way to look at it?
That is a correct way to look at it. I don't have great data on this yet, but I can tell you from everything I've studied and the fact that we don't have a great data on this is kind of data itself. And so it's this, which is that we don't have any data that says outdoor events are associated with big super spreader events. We don't, you know, it's like, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter protest, thousands of people, you know, you saw them, they were wearing masks, but they were hanging off and a lot of people didn't have them. But we don't have a huge surge in cases after that, right? This thing spreads best inside closed contact in a room. And I think the best way we could imagine that is, imagine that you took a dropper with some really, like food dye, right? We've all done this in the kitchen as kids, right? You put the drop in and it spreads kind of complex, right? Oh, yeah. All through that glass, but that glass gets full. If you drop that into a moving river, you're not even going to notice it. Where'd it go, right? So it's the same concept, which is that it really spreads best in a closed environment, particularly if you don't have any good airflow flushing stuff out. That's it. We also know that it spreads really good when people are singing in a church. Something about singing, you know, we're in close proximity. People are taking big gulps of air to sing that next thing out. We have tons of super spreader events when people are singing indoors in a closed environment. Didn't have to be a church, didn't mean to pick on that, but that's we have a lot of data around that. So here's the summary is, this thing spreads, but it doesn't spread super easily. You kind of have to be in proximity without a lot of airflow, and it helps if people are either coughing or singing or yelling or in some way expressing like that. But outdoors, I don't worry about it at all, to be honest. Maybe I should, but I don't.
And so then, of course, I'm thinking, then why do we lock people in their houses?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That would be kind of counterproductive there, huh?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really, a lot of the things that are being done from a decision standpoint at the, I don't call them health authorities, I call them managers now, because an authority would actually, you know, use the best possible data. And by the way, there are countries that are doing a great job at this. The United States is doing a pretty, I wouldn't say singularly bad, because I can point to other countries, but pretty much at the bottom of, like, all the things you could try and do, we're doing a lot of very counterproductive things. And that shows up in the data. We're one of the last countries really struggling with hospital overwhelm. India isn't struggling with that. Pakistan isn't struggling with that. You know, Peru isn't struggling with that. Why us?
Yeah, so why are we?
Because we're doing all sorts of things wrong. The lockdowns are counterproductive, for starters. Second of all, we don't have any good prophylaxis. We're not there. Here's current state of care, NIH. Go to their website. And their current state of care says, if somebody comes to a doctor and they express symptoms, the doctor says, go home. If they get worse, come back. That's it. They don't even say eat chicken soup. There's like literally no guidance. Lots of other countries have figured out there are many effective things you can do. And many of those things, if I even talk about them, the pharma goons are gonna ding your channel. And so I don't even talk about them anymore. That's the country I live in. So we have no prophylaxis, and we're telling people to go home where it spreads the best. And then we have all these really weird exclusions for essential, which again can spread it. So in Australia right now, it just came out this morning that if you live it like in New South Wales or something like that, like it's beautiful, it's open, you could go to the beach, it's summer. No, you got to stay home locked down. But if you work for an airline, there's no quarantine, no automatic quarantine for pilots or stewardesses coming in. No quarantine for them. But for you as a citizen, there is. And it's just backwards, because obviously you might think that people who are flying in a closed tube coming from hotspots might be more of a vector than somebody who's just hanging out, living their life in a place with very, very low levels of transmission right now. So it's just examples like that. There's hundreds of them.
Yeah, I was just on a plane going to Las Vegas, and man, it was getting me fired up, because I was trying to sleep a little bit, and I'm 6'4", so I got a big head, and that blue little mask thing, it kept going, like slipping down a little bit when I was falling asleep, and the stewardess gal kept tapping me on the shoulder and waking me up every 5 minutes to pull the mask up. Meanwhile, half the plane had no masks on whatsoever, just getting lit off vodka and tonics and, you know, drinking their alcohol. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, how does this make any sense at all? But one question I want to ask, because I know this has kind of been a moving target. I started talking about this with Eric Townsend, and obviously you were right at the forefront of this back in January. And you had some data, but not everything. But now that we have a little bit more data, how is this? Well, I guess the question would be: is this the flu? And if not, why?
Well, it's a little bit of both. It's a pretty bad disease. If it's untreated or you don't have effective treatments for it, it's a very bad thing, right? So, what's different about it is that it came, where however it arose, and there's a lot of controversy about where it came from and how, it came out of the gate perfectly tuned for the human body. And it doesn't just come in through the ACE2 receptor, which would be bad enough, right? That means it gets into the lungs, nasopharyngeal area. It's got access through the gut, the testes. It's got a ton of ways. It's like a burglar who's got a perfect key to get into your house. But this burglar also can tunnel in, because it can go in through, now we know, at least 5, but possibly 6 receptors. So that makes it a little different. It's harder to fight, because it comes in and can do all kinds of things. So one of the keys gets it in through a receptor called neuropilin-1. That's heavily expressed in neuronal tissue. That's, it explains what they call anosmia, but that's a loss of sense of smell and taste, which is really actually pretty, people have described that as one of the worst outcomes of this for them, because they lose, they lose weight because they don't even like food anymore. It's lost all sense of smell and taste. So this thing is not like the flu, because it can come in through so many different gates. And when it comes in, it also really ravages the body, again, if it's untreated. Now, we're not in the bad old days of February and March where they just crammed people on ventilators and hoped for the best. We have really effective treatments now, and so that's the good news. The great news, which I'm really happy about, is I think this has taught me and a lot of other people about viruses. Flu is almost crushed in this flu season. It's just because people are taking some of these other minimal precautions. You remember the bad old days? You'd be on that plane to Vegas, right? And there would be that person who would come in and they're just dripping and sneezing and just like not even...
Yeah,
not,
the hacking cough, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and you just know they're just spreading the whole thing around. I just hated those flights because I'm trained and I'm like, geez, I don't want to get sick, you know? So we've learned a lot, and we've learned how to control viruses, and we've learned, you know, how to have good prophylaxis against this. But, and this is the part I can't say without getting either of us in trouble, there are cheap, pretty much over the counter in most countries, remedies that fairly effective by all the data. We have randomized clinical trials, we have observational studies, we've got all this data pouring in from around the world. But I will tell you that India right now, they have a death count on a per million basis that's 1/9 the United States. They have 100 people per million in India, with all of its slums, its complete inability to socially distance, people who don't have the option to just stay home and not work, like none of that's going on. And their death rate is 1/9 the United States on an adjusted per million basis. So how is that? Well, they're busy distributing these little blister packs with four different things in there, which I've talked about extensively on my show. Vitamin D is one. I think we can still say that safely. Zinc is another. Can say that. So they just went through the data and said, oh, here are things that actually work. And they distribute these things, and they cost about $1.50 for a protocol. Then they're just handing them out. So they've actually really done a great job. And if we did the same thing, we could get right back to work probably in a couple of weeks, no question. If India can do it, I'm pretty sure we could do it. We're just not. And there's a whole story there that's...
Yeah, who knows? So how about age, Chris? Like, is this something that for an age group of, let's say, 60 and above, they should be concerned with and really take precautions, but maybe below 60 and not so much, and below 40 is go ahead and get it so we can get up to herd immunity as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I can do you one better than that. So maybe I'll send you this chart and you want to, you know, sort of stitch it in, but I can describe it. Imagine we have a log chart. And the log chart is mortality running up the left axis, and we've got age running across the right axis. And so log chart. You can draw a dead straight line up that thing at a 45-degree angle, and it just simply says that as a function of age, you have an exponentially increasing chance of mortality with this thing. So it's, if you want it, like, it's perfect straight line. It doesn't sort of wobble anywhere. It's not an S-curve that's complicated to explain. It's a straight line. So it means that, you know, for every decade you're chopping off, you know, you're exponentially decreasing the risk. So below, you know, certain age, the risk is so negligible of mortality that shouldn't be the thing that gets us worried. What does worry me, though, still, remember I mentioned this is like a burglar with five keys to get into your house. It still leaves some people pretty messed up. And so untreated, I think this is something everybody would like to avoid, because you don't know that roll of the dice. You know, you're going to be one of those people with cardiac issues, with long-term lung damage, with long-term, what they call long hauler syndrome, kidneys, all that stuff. It's not good. And we now have effective ways of combating that, I think. So,
yeah. As someone who, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would assume through watching your content for many, many years, you kind of lean more libertarian. And you're not a big fan of big government and central planning. How do you reconcile the lockdowns and what is now just incredibly excessive government control? And my big concern going into this, even back in January, is I said, listen, you know, we don't know how bad this is going to be. You should take precautions. We should be cognizant of this. But one thing I don't want is government coming in and doing anything other than just giving us information and allowing us to make our own decisions as to how careful or not we want to be. Because once they cross that line, they never go back. I mean, 9/11 is a fantastic example of that. And I guess the extension to that question would be, now that the government has crossed this line in our lives and can just on a whim say, okay, you're locked in your house, you're in jail, you can't go to the beach, you can't open your business, you can't do these things. What happens in 3 years when we get another something that may not be as bad, but just their kind of go-to response mechanism is lockdown? Lockdown. I mean, are we now in this perpetual cycle where every 2 or 3 years the government comes in and just locks everything down and people are okay with it just because we need to see if this is, you know, something that we should be concerned with or not? Or, I mean, how does this play out from a personal liberty standpoint?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This is the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. It's under there, it never goes back away. And we saw this with 9/11, right? Remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember what it was like when you could just sort of basically walk onto an airplane and then one dude with explosive underwear, next thing you know, we're all getting millimeter wave scanned with our privates on display and groped, you know? And so you watch that happen and my whole reaction at the time was like, wait, this was one person who tried this and suddenly 300 million people have to lose a lot of liberty around that on a risk adjusted basis. Does this make sense? What are we trading off? But there was no conversation around that. It was just safety was more important. And now we have the same issue, which is public safety is more important than your individual rights. And so, you know, this is the whole collectivist versus individual. Where do you fall on that? And I'm very much libertarian is one way to look at it. I believe, you know, my larger work in the world, George, is that there's some really big predicaments facing us. And we're going to have to bring our very best critical thinking skills to the bear. And we can only do that when individuals have freedom to speak their minds freely. And we're going the other way from that right now and very strongly to the point where New York Times, we're seeing this now, they're arguing that vaccinations ought to be mandatory, right? Which means that's an encroachment on the idea that you have some sense of individual agency over how and what goes into your body, right? Right. And then to your point is, well, what's after that, right? So that the whole sweep of this thing has been more and more and more governmental control and less individual liberty, to the point where you see now, at a whim, the mayor of LA says, you're shut down, little business with a tent outside, but these movie people with their tents, they can still serve food. It's capricious and it's weird and it's very difficult to, I think, have a vibrant, growing economy, which we need if we want to solve or approach many of the problems I think that we can all feel coming. I'm a big believer that we need that individual agency. And that's the biggest thing I'm concerned about here is this freezing of ideas, of thoughts. My own platform has run into trouble because I'm daring to talk about scientific findings that I can point towards. I can show you the studies. And there's now a vein of thinking which says you can't do that. You know, leave that to the government will tell you when it's okay to have those thoughts. And so we're at that stage of the story. I think this is actually one of the most important periods of history. I think what happens in the next few years really sets the stage for how much people are going to enjoy anything we might know to be individual freedom or even the ability to decide your own economic fate or future by doing something as risky as opening a business, right? That's where we're at.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com /pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, and you notice that there's no discussion of a cost-benefit analysis. None in anything. I mean, I don't know if you listen to Tom Woods. I listen to his podcast all the time, and he's done some great work showing that, okay, we know the perceived benefit of let's say, a lockdown or something, but we don't look at all the people who have died as a result of those lockdowns or as a result of, you know, closing businesses or, you know, it's like Hazlitt. You know, we've got to not only focus on what's seen, but also the unseen. And I always kind of remember my favorite economist, Thomas Sowell, is that, you know, there's no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And I think as a society, we've completely ignored the fact that, especially with something like this, there are some trade-offs, and there needs to be open, you know, serious, intellectually honest debate around those trade-offs. And I'm just not seeing it anywhere. It's either you're on one side or the other. They don't talk, and it's black or white. There's no gray area, you know?
Yeah. It's a great point, George. Really great point. And, you know, my background in pathology and my subspecialty toxicology, so it's all statistics. So if somebody came to me as a pathologist and said, I smoke 4 packs a day, am I going to die from lung cancer? And I go, maybe. You know, it's just like we live in a world of grays, right? So if right now, the most horrible thing in America is to die from COVID. There's no thing worse that could possibly happen to you. That's it. And we're going to throw everything out the window without a discussion just because it's that horrible. Maybe it's that horrible. But as a pathologist, I might go, yeah, but 3 million people a year die from alcohol directly and indirectly in this country. So where's the discussion? How horrible? Why isn't that horrible? Why isn't 3 million deaths from alcohol so horrible that we go back to prohibition, right? Well, because then all of a sudden people would say, hey, hold it. I think we should have a serious rocking conversation before you take my right to drink away. But you know that's coming if we don't have this conversation now. Do I want to catch COVID? No. Is it a bad disease if you get it and it's untreated? Yes. Is it worth the cost of the lockdowns? No, because we haven't had that trade-off conversation. I named alcohol, I could name you 10 things that are higher on the risks thing that are worse than that, right? You know, and so we're not having those conversations, which just tells me that our culture isn't, something's happening here that I think you and I are sort of nibbling around the edges of, which is there's something going on here, and maybe it isn't so much about the disease. Maybe it's about all the ways in which certain players and participants are using that in order to advance certain agendas that they happen to have, which I totally get, right? There's money involved, there's power, there's ego, it's usual stuff, but maybe we could just have that conversation directly and say, is that what we want to do here?
I went back and looked at the data from the Spanish flu in 1918, and I noticed, ironically enough, that really hit the United States in March, pretty much the same month, but a few years ago. And then what happened is you get that first wave, the second wave in the fall, and then the spring, you get kind of a third wave. And then it really just fizzled out because people reached, I guess we reached herd immunity in the United States. Obviously, there wasn't a vaccine back then. So I was thinking that, okay, we're on that same timeline now. You know, if we didn't have this vaccine, would we have potentially just got up to herd immunity by that point anyway? And therefore, maybe the vaccine isn't as necessary as the media would lead us to believe? Or am I just not seeing it correctly?
This is a really complicated question. I hate to be that guy. Everything's got a lot of details. But it turns out that the Spanish flu was a form of influenza. And this is a coronavirus, and our bodies through, you know, life has been fighting with viruses, if you want to look at it that way, or coexisting for a long time. And so really elegant strategies have been worked out. And for whatever reason, through history and evolutionary history, our bodies decided that they were going to fight coronaviruses for the most part with a T cell immunity, which I've talked about a lot because it's very different from the B cell, which is what they're trying to do with these vaccines is get your immune system up so that it recognizes a foreign antigen, you make antibodies against it. That's one way to do it. The other way is you have these cells which recognize foreign invaders. So it makes it more complicated because here's what we know. We know that some people, when they get this thing, are completely asymptomatic. Nothing ever happens to them, but we can detect that they were exposed because their T cells are all activated. So they have this immunity that's not coming through the same path as the vaccine. The second thing that our bodies have decided to do with coronaviruses is when they do mount what the vaccine is giving us, which is an antibody response, it doesn't hold on to it. So the antibody response goes away, and it goes away fairly quickly. So we don't know what that means yet. It might mean that we're on a constant every 6 months, you're just getting revaccinated with this thing. We don't know yet because we don't have enough time and data on this. So I hate to be complicated about this, but you know, the idea that you give everybody a vaccine once, we achieve this thing called herd immunity, and this thing goes away more or less like the Spanish flu did, I'm not sure that's how this is going to work out with this virus because it's a coronavirus and our bodies just deal with it very differently. So we I hate to be this way, but we just don't know.
Would we have gotten to herd immunity without a vaccine?
Yes, of course we would. That'll always happen. But it's kind of like saying, did we ever get to herd immunity with the common cold, which are different variants of the coronavirus and other things, but of the coronaviruses that give us what we call the common cold, you never really totally achieve full herd immunity to those because our immune response wanes over time. So they come around, and you know all of that. So herd immunity would always mean it's endemic. There's a certain amount of it. The spikes a little bit, but the spikes aren't as bad as that first time. So we had a really bad first wave in places where it just sort of took us by surprise. Let's say New York would be an example. Mm-hmm. Right. I would be very surprised if we ever saw a wave like that again, but we could have a second wave, but it would be less. And this is all without the idea that maybe somehow this virus mutates and you know has a second life in a different sort of a form. But as it's configured with this virus is what we know about it. My belief is your first wave is the worst one. You do have these so-called second waves that come through, but they haven't, like we see this in London, we see this in Spain, we see this in Italy, places that had a really bad first wave. They're having a second wave, but they're not nearly as pronounced as the first wave.
And are they less severe from a standpoint of the number of people that get infected, or are they less severe with the cases themselves, or both?
I think I can answer B. The cases themselves are less severe because we do have more effective treatments for them in the hospital setting. We know to use steroids and stuff. But the first part, I can't answer because we keep changing the testing protocol. So we're running tests now that come up with a lot of cases, but these cases that are being detected are not epidemiologically relevant or clinically relevant because it's a little wonky again, but they run these tests and they're tests where they're exponentially amplifying the signal. And we know that if you do that above what's called 35 cycles, that anything above that, people aren't transmissive, they aren't sick, maybe it's old fragments, we don't know. But for the most part, you can ignore readings above 35 from a public health standpoint. And in the United States, as long as, you know, we're running tests at 40 cycles, 45, 42, it's kind of up to the states, but you have to run a minimum of 38 for it to be a reasonable test according to the FDA. So when we test these things, we get these things back that sound, they're calling them cases, George, they're not cases. They're detected SARS-CoV-2 virus particles. We don't know if it's a live virus, an inactivated one, old fragments, we don't know. But a case, to be clear, I hate to be pedantic, a case should be somebody who has symptoms that require medical attention. That's what it used to mean. We don't know what it means anymore. So I wish I could tell you where we are in this story, but we have bad data and you can't run good analyses on bad data.
Right, right. And again, it goes back to what we were saying is we've got to try to just look at all of the data that we have at our disposal and just have a debate on the costs and the benefits, short-term and long-term, and then try to just minimize the government intrusion, but just give the people the information as accurate as information as we have and give them access to the debates from the professionals and then let them come to their own conclusions as to what is right or wrong for their family and their business. That seems obvious to me.
Seems obvious to me too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last question on this topic is so we got a vaccine coming out. As a professional, are you going to take it? Why or why not?
No, I'm gonna sit back and wait and watch. Fortunately, I have that luxury. We're talking from my little hidey hole in Western Massachusetts. I live on a fairly extensive piece of land, and my business allows me not to have a lot of contact with the public. But if I was going to be in a hospital setting, I'm a bus driver, an airline pilot, or my company requires me to have it, I have a very different decision to make. So I'm speaking from a point of privilege, and that privilege allows me to say I'd rather wait. And this is actually a very scientific discussion, because first, we've never had an mRNA vaccine before. So it's a whole new technology and platform. My experience in as a scientist is it never works quite like you think. Nature's pretty clever and complex. And sometimes you have to just run the experiment and watch what happens, because complex systems have emergent behaviors. They don't have predictable behaviors.
Right.
So watch for what emerges, right? That's just how it works. The second thing is they really cut a lot of corners on this. I know they're saying that they didn't, but they had to, right? So here's a study they haven't run. Hey, we put this into primates, monkeys, and we let them have it for a year, and then we expose them to various variants of this virus and regular cold viruses to see what happens. That would be a normal thing that would happen in a typical vaccine development. We didn't have time or the luxury of that, so it didn't get done.
Right.
And it may be the best thing ever. This mRNA vaccine technology could be the greatest thing that ever happened since the first smallpox jab from the cowpox that proved the principle back in the 1800s, right? That's possible. And it could be that we're going to learn some things. So I know a lot of professional virologists, immunologists, people who've all told me personally that they're just going to wait and watch too. And we're starting to see some stories like that sneak out, right? They want to pretend as if everybody just wants this right away. But we're finding out that a lot of people who are in the healthcare profession are saying, I'd like to wait too. It's about a 50-60% mark of people who are in that profession are going, I don't know. And they have the same concerns I do, which is, and this would have been best, if the companies involved in these things had been very forthcoming with their data, I would feel differently. Here's an example. The Pfizer-BioNTech one that they just came out with, I looked through all this voluminous data they put out, and they broke down the groups into under 55 and over 55. And the doctors I talked to are like, that's not, we have computers. You can do this by 5-year bands or 10-year bands at most. And that would be the normal way to present this, because over 55 is meaningless. What does it mean to give it to an 85-year-old is different from 75, 60.
Right.
But they just sort of said over 55. So the to people who study these things, there's a reason when a company groups things in that way, and it's because they thought it looked better when they grouped it that way. So it's just, if they really wanted to create a lot of comfort for people like me who like data, they would have broken the data out in the usual way. And then we could have looked at big tables and said, is there any difference by age? Oh, no, great. But the fact that they grouped it like that is not confidence inspiring. And, this is just being, this is just how the world works, right? Companies have an interest in, look, 90% of every study that's ever been run by a pharma company that got put into JAMA or, Lancet or anything like that, 90% of them showed that their experiments worked and that their drugs did what they said they were going to do. How is that possible? You would think every so often, law of random averages, things wouldn't quite go your way. And it's really funny, if competitor A tests their stuff against competitor B, their trials win, and vice versa. It just tells you that this thing, this is just humans. It's the law of incentives. As Charlie Munger, Buffett's right-hand man, said, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. I'm a huge believer in that. And I think that means that the bar is even higher for people who want to come through a rush protocol, not lower, because we're in such a hurry.
Yeah. I was listening to another doctor from Stanford on Tom Wood's podcast the other day, and he said that he was basically suggesting to patients that based on their age, again, if you're under 50 years old, you might want to think twice about it, because the vaccine might have more downside than you actually getting the virus you're trying to protect yourself against. But if you're over a certain age group, or you're 400 pounds, or you're, you know, diabetic, or you have one of these high risk, you're in one of these high risk categories, then, you know, you might want to think about it. That's kind of how he broke it down. It made a lot of sense. What are you doing in your own life, Chris, to increase your personal freedom? I know this is something you talk about on your channel, and you're actually living it yourself. And I'm very good friends with Lynette Zhang, and this is a strategy and approach that she's taking as well in her own personal life. And I think it's very interesting, because most people that watch my channel, you know, they want to increase their personal liberty and their personal freedom in a world where that's becoming increasingly difficult to do.
Yeah. So, listen, my philosophy is control what you can and leave the rest. I can't do anything about Federal Reserve printing. I mean, I just put a video out yesterday showing the explosion in M1 money stock. I mean, I'm like,
yeah.
Like, what little hair I have left just caught on fire and burned. Yes. 66% increase year over year. Oh my, you know, so what? Yeah. So I buy gold, and I buy real estate, and I buy hard assets, and I think about Bitcoin and stuff like that. I can't control that, but I can control what I do with my currency units. I'm very concerned about all the things the Great Reset people are talking about. And so, take a couple of hop, skips, and jumps. My personal strategy is I bought a piece of property. It's got okay land on it, but I'm improving the soil as fast as I can. And for the first time in my life, we got cows, we raised pigs this year, we got some chickens, got a garden. Because I have this feeling, this crazy idea, that I would like to have my calories as close as possible going forward. And it feels right too, because I can address a lot of the things that concern me. I can't do anything about all the use of pesticides in industrial agriculture, but I can make sure that my local little corner of the universe is really abundant for all the plants and animals that want to come inhabit that. And my abundance is their abundance, and their abundance is my abundance. So that's what we're doing. And I like to live around beauty. I'd rather not live in a degraded, rundown, sort of fully extracted environment. So these are all things I can control, and they feel good to me. It's a great pastime. I love being outside. I love tending animals and plants and things like that. But that's me. But everything I'm doing here is about, really, if you listen carefully, I'm building the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of need: food, shelter, safety, warmth. I want to make sure I've got those attended to, because I'm really concerned that all of this hyperprinting leads in a bad outcome. I don't find examples in history that say this is awesome, because our currency is our social contract, and somebody's eroding it. And they know not what they do. They've got their fancy formulas and Taylor rules and yada yada, but what they're really doing is they're eroding the unit of trust that we have with each other and with the larger system. So I'm an advocate of Straussenhaus fourth turning. This all feels very fourth turning-ish. We're seeing this mass erosion in faith in institutions, much of it well deserved. And sometimes those things end a little abruptly or disruptively. So what do I do about that is I control what I can. So I love knowing that I have not only abundance here for me and my own close family, but for a lot of other people. That's just the best I think I can do, is be a real asset to my community. And if other people need to, you know, share in the abundance I'm creating, I'm all for it. So I'm really starting to be more local in my thinking, even though I'm a real global thinker. I can't think of what else to do at this point besides become as resilient as possible in my own home life.
Yeah, resilient. I think that's the word that you used in that video I watched of yours. And I think that's the key: to be self-reliant and as resilient as possible. Anti-fragile, I think, is a good way to look at it. So, okay, Chris, I really enjoyed the conversation, but we're going to actually continue this conversation on your channel. So everyone that's watching this right now or listening to it, you've got to click off this video and go right over to Chris's channel, which, Chris, is it Peak Prosperity?
PeakProsperity.com, yep, is the website. And Peak Prosperity will get you over to our YouTube channel. And then we're also on starting to show up on Parler, Rumble, Odyssey, which is a library piece. So we're starting to thread out, so people can start to find us all over the place now.
Okay, fantastic. So just search us in one of those locations, and then we're going to do the second part of the interview and continue the conversation over there. So I can't wait to dive in even deeper. Chris, I appreciate your time, and I guess I'll see you right over on the other side.
All right, see you there. Great conversation. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.